Jake Tapper's on the line with us from Washington, D.C., where we'd expect him to be, actually. And Jake, I was calling him the ABC's man in the White House there, but apparently he's made a little shift here, which maybe we can ask him about. And so I'm not supposed to say that anymore. I mentioned those three letters.
Don't do it.
Okay. And he's on the line with us from Washington, Jake Tapper. New book is called The Outpost. It's a great book, by the way. Jake, are you there?
I'm here.
Did you know you're at CNN now?
I just read a press release that said that.
Yeah. Did that come as a shock to you?
No. I'm very excited. I'm going to get my own show.
Got your own show. All right.
Yeah. We're going to call it What Do You Know?
That's more proper, I got to admit. That's good. Is it going to be a comedy quiz show sort of thing, or what's the format going to be?
I think it'll just be a general news show with a lot of politics, breaking news.
No.
You know, we're still in the working stages.
You're working with Ashley Banfield? Will she be a co-host? Or?
No, it'll just be me.
Just you? Okay.
Although maybe she'll lend me her glasses.
That's a good thing. So, Jake, where have you been?
That's funny.
Yeah, not even to you, I don't think, but that you did ask that to President Obama, and I thought I'd turn the tables on you there. But
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Do you want me to talk about gun violence, or do you want to ask where I've been the last 3 weeks?
The last 3 weeks, because I follow you on Twitter, and your tweets have been just sort of random, and you're watching TV, and you're...
Well, I'm between gigs right now. I'm no longer the ABC News White House correspondent, but my contract doesn't run out until after the inaugural, so that I can't start my CNN job until after then. So I feel like Ron Livingston in Office Space after he got hypnotized, kind of in a strange, serene place.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, actually. I think. But so you're gonna miss all the inaugural stuff, and
yeah,
I guess you can't.
I've done it before, though.
Yeah, did they cancel your press credentials and all that, or?
Yep.
Will those expire?
No, just they've been returned to the authorities.
Yeah, this is quite a bit. I mean, I'm a little. This were you planning on this for a long time? It was kind of a shock because I looked for you on the evening news there, and I'm sort of used to you being there.
I was my contract was up, and
yeah,
there was this opportunity. You know, basically,
yeah,
I could stay at the White House annoying Jay Carney for another 4 years. Or
good at it though.
Yeah, I felt like I'm really good at annoying him.
Yeah.
Or I could try something new, and I wanted to try something new. And
yeah,
Jeff Zucker just took over CNN, and he's obviously a legend in the business, and I wanted to, you know, anchoring's fun. You do it.
Not really. No.
Yeah.
I drag my anchor quite a bit. But
Anyways, I was looking, you know, but it's weird having been a journalist, part of the day-to-day and hour-to-hour conversation and news coverage. It's weird suddenly being on this planet of not covering anything. It's weird. This week I was forced to start my own Tumblr account because I don't have anywhere where I can write anything.
Mm-hmm. Kind of sad, but it'll pass. It'll pass. That feeling will pass.
Yeah, it's a first world problem.
Yeah. Did it feel at all odd you and Rush Limbaugh gave you a shout-out?
It always feels weird when somebody partisan on the left or right praises my work just because I don't think of myself as aligned ideologically with either side.
Yeah.
So, you know, and a lot of times I think a lot of people praising are just happy that somebody's either taking it to one side or the other. They don't even care what the question is. Like, conservatives praised me when I asked President Obama where he'd been on gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really a question, from the right. They just were happy that somebody was challenging President Obama.
But didn't you ask him one time why he wasn't wearing a flag pin or something like that?
I asked him, this was during the primaries. You got a good memory. I think it was in Lorain, Ohio, and I asked him about the assaults on his patriotism the conservatives were going to make.
Mm-hmm.
This was before he'd even lost the Ohio primary. And I cited, I don't know if I cited the flag pin, but I cited a number of things that they were going to attack him on.
Mm-hmm.
And but it wasn't like I shared the view of the patriotism challenges. It was just, I was, you know, how right. are you going to respond when these challenges come, which they did to little effect.
But you called him out on smoking, too, didn't you, one time? I mean, you're pretty hard on the guy.
Well, this is really obscure, but yes, one, I didn't call him out on smoking. One time, this is back in the day when I was a congressional correspondent,
oh.
and he had famously quit smoking, and I was covering the Senate, and, you know, one of the great things about covering Capitol Hill is they're all right there. All the policymakers are right there, and you can grab them in the hall. They can't escape you. In the White House, they can escape you quite easily. Mm-hmm. So he was there right outside the Senate chamber, and he reeked of cigarette smoke. And I asked his campaign about it. I just said he famously had, like, quit smoking on Oprah or something. And he smells like RJR and Nabisco. What's going on?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Not Nabisco. You mean Reynolds, right?
RJR Reynolds. Haven't they combined, though?
Probably the same parent company.
Yes, he didn't smell like vanilla wafers.
Yeah.
I agree. I agree with your assessment of that.
Okay, all right. I'm glad we got that out of the way. Your new book is The Outpost. This is an amazing book, Jake.
Thank you. We just got great news. One of the soldiers in the book, President Obama announced yesterday he's going to be awarding him with the Medal of Honor, which means so much to these guys to have one of their own recognized for how brave he was that day.
And who is that?
He's no longer in the Army. He was Staff Sergeant. Clint Romache, he now lives in North Dakota, a fascinating guy. And the basic story, the short story is there's this outpost put in this impossible place, the bottom of three steep mountains, 40 miles from the Pakistan border. And it had been attacked, you know, relentlessly for 3.5 years. And then finally the big attack came, up to 400 Taliban. And the guys were sitting ducks in this fishbowl, and the Taliban killed 8 of the Americans, and they actually got inside the camp, and it just reporting on this, I have nightmares about it. I don't know how these guys dealt with it, but one of the guys, this guy Clint Romache, Sergeant Romache, he got together a squad of guys, and they said, we're going to take the camp back.
Yeah.
And he just pushed west and took over that side of the camp and routed the enemy, and it's he's an unbelievably brave guy, and he's an interesting guy. He comes from a Mormon family in California, and he was more suited for this kind of mission, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I see your guy Karzai is in D.C.
Yeah,
I guess
out.
They're turning it over to him, is what I understand. Is that your understanding?
I think that they're heading for the exits.
Heading for the
pretty
exits.
Pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what's so great about this book is that, first of all, it's very moving and really, you know, finally something about the guys who are over there fighting and what they're fighting for and what we're trying to do. That's part of what we don't know even. It's never been really written about. What the mission, it's never been determined exactly, has it, what the mission is in Afghanistan.
It's been confusing for a lot of people. Right now the mission is training the Afghan security forces, but at the time of the book, from 2006 to 2009, the goal was counterinsurgency, which basically means winning over the locals so that they will take the fight or at least eject the enemy from their midst.
Yeah.
But by profiling this one camp, I was hopefully able to show how difficult it is to do that and what the difficulties exactly are. And as you say, who these men and women are and what their stories are.
Right. And this was in Nuristan, which is something that I think most of us don't know even exists.
It's a province that is, it's like the Afghanistan of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's its own distinct ethnic group. They are hostile to outsiders, and when they refer to outsiders, they're referring to Afghans. Mm-hmm. And it's where a lot of your listeners probably know The Man Who Would Be King takes place, the Rudyard Kipling novella and the film with Michael Caine and Sean Connery.
Right.
They're legendarily untamed. They were the last ones to convert to Islam in the 19th century, the first ones to take up arms against the Soviets in the 70s. And so when America pushes in there, I mean, this is a camp, Camp Combat Outpost Keating, which I write about, that literally there are 3 hollowed out Soviet personnel carriers outside the camp.
Yeah.
Not exactly a reassuring landmark.
No. Which sort of brings up the prequel to all this is that having seen what happened to the Russians, regarding Afghanistan, what actually more or less changed their country after that. Russia was never the same after their Afghanistan experience. How is it possible that the U.S. went into Afghanistan on that sort of basis?
Is one thing, yeah. Because obviously they wanted to rout the Taliban and kill al-Qaeda, but the question of what to do then is really the challenge. And that's been the problem with the last decade there. What to do? How do you make sure it doesn't become a safe haven for terrorists again? And you're right. I mean, and there are a lot of troops pushing into Afghanistan in the book in 2006, 5 years after the war started, and then pushing into this east part of Afghanistan, right next to where the enemy actually is in that state whose name shall not be spoken, Pakistan. And these guys are not only aware of the Soviets and their excursions and problems there, but how difficult it was for the Greeks and Alexander the Great. And you know, one of the lieutenants in the book, Ben Keating, who the camp is named after, tells a journalist there, you know, we're fighting against thousands of years of history here.
Right, exactly. And and the British, of course, the British experience too before the Russians.
Yeah.
And then it certainly calls into question, like, not just the rationale for being there, but sort of the plans on the ground. You know, and you mentioned Joseph Heller at one point in there in Catch-22 and all that. There's a chapter in there that's entitled something like, "This is not a good idea," or something. This whole thing is a bad idea.
This whole thing's a bad idea, right?
Yeah, and certainly, just looking at where that camp was placed, or they might have needed an outpost camp. Obviously, they probably did, but to put it in a valley that where it's vulnerable from three sides, basically.
And this is where the decisions of people in Washington, D.C. play a role, because one of the reasons they had to put the camp there, this is mountainous terrain, so it's either going to be on top of a mountain or at the bottom of a mountain. They couldn't put it on top of the mountain because in 2006, almost all the helicopters were in Iraq. So to resupply the camp, they couldn't rely on helicopters, so they had to rely on the road. And if you're going to put a camp next to a road, then you're going to be putting it at the bottom of a mountain.
Yeah.
And so when Rumsfeld and Bush did not send enough assets to Afghanistan, they were setting the conditions for situations like this.
Mm-hmm. And then these young men, you know, average age, 24, one of their jobs was not just the military part of it, but they had to sort of win the hearts and minds of the people and start these projects and so forth. And yet it's difficult to know just how you would do that under these circumstances.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. I mean, we ask these young men and women, many of whom, you know, barely graduated high school, to be diplomats to this part of the world that doesn't want Western influences there at all. I mean, when they and when they think of Western influences, they're thinking of Kabul. You know, they don't want the government of Afghanistan there,
right?
Much less Americans. I mean, when these guys set foot in 2006 in a lot of these towns and these hamlets, they thought they were the Soviets. The Afghans thought that these American soldiers were the Soviets who had just come back 15 years later.
Mm-hmm.
They'd never heard of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the way asking them to be diplomats, to be civil engineers, to be soldiers, an impossible task. And anyway, so working on this book for 2.5 years, it was. I think what I came away from, in addition to if you're going to send troops over there and make sure they have everything they need, was just how lucky we are as a country to have young men and women who are willing to do this, purportedly for you and me and the people listening to this show, for our safety.
Yeah, and yet this is almost the first book that really has talked about their mission there and what they're going through there, what they've gone through there, and the setting itself. Really, it hasn't been talked about at all. We certainly heard a lot about Vietnam during that, and that sort of changed the course of that war. And we've heard about Iraq, although not quite in the same way as Vietnam. But what have we heard about the war in Afghanistan?
Well, this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, because of my own shortcomings as a journalist. Mm-hmm. I had been covering the war in Afghanistan from the comfort of the North Lawn of the White House. But I didn't understand what our troops were doing over there. I didn't understand the mission, other than in, you know, what I read in the New York Times or what the Pentagon press secretary said from the podium. I didn't really understand. What does that mean, counterinsurgency? How do you win people over other than throwing money at them? And I kind of was just driven to write this book. It was actually serendipitous. I was in the hospital with my wife and my newborn son, Jack, and I looked up a day or two after he was born, and there was this report on this obscure outpost that had been overrun, and I didn't understand why the troops were there, why they would be placed in such a incredibly vulnerable place, who they were, who the eight sons were. I was holding my son, hearing about eight sons that had been taken from us. Who were these people? Who was Justin Gallegos or Stephen Mace or the eight guys whose names showed up in the newspaper? And it just set me on this course to report it. And it's just been probably, without question, I should say, the most life-changing journalistic assignment ever. Just because, I'll speak only for myself. I think my coverage of the wars has been rather glib. Talking about this surge or that surge, 40,000, 10,000, McChrystal versus Obama. And it's much more serious than that.
Mm-hmm. And so much of it comes from the guys themselves and from their family and from, it comes from them, not from the high on up, whatever the plans are from the generals and such.
Yeah. And the soldiers got so, and their families got so invested in the book because they were so happy to have anybody listening to their stories and wanting to tell their stories that it became a project much bigger than me and my personal professional ambitions.
Mm-hmm. And there's also something about the guys who come home and how that has changed them. Did you find out much about that or what's going on with returning veterans from Afghanistan? And
yeah, they're having, a lot of these guys are now my friends, and a lot of them are going through tough times. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are getting divorced, and a lot of them are, can't sleep. And it's difficult. I mean, in addition to post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, it's just, they see their friends die. And, for these guys, the guys in Black Knight Troop 361 CAV, who were there during the October 3rd, 2009 attack, eight of their buddies died. Eight of their buddies were killed. And a lot of them still grapple with why. Why were they there? Because at the point that they were there, there were four different deployments that I go through from 2006 to 2009. But at the point that the guys from Black Knight Troop were there, the camp didn't really accomplish anything. It was, as their lieutenant colonel referred to it once, it was like a self-licking ice cream cone. It only existed unto itself. Its only purpose was its own defense. And the lieutenant colonel and the colonel had told McChrystal they wanted to close the camp. And a couple others, and McChrystal wouldn't let them because Karzai didn't want them to before the election as well. There were some other reasons as well that I go into in the book, but it's kind of glib. You got 53 U.S. troops there, and he doesn't want to close the camp, at least partly because Karzai doesn't want him to before the election because it will signify weakness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it is a great book. It's a great piece of writing, and it definitely needed to be written. It's a real tribute to you that you did it, and did it so well. So it's The Outpost, an untold story of American valor. Is there anything along these lines coming up from you in the future? I know this is the first you did. I know you did the Jesse Ventura book, which is not quite the same thing.
Yeah, that was a little different.
So this was a little unexpected.
World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah, and then you did the thing on the vote fraud.
Although Jesse Ventura did serve, we should point out, in Subic Bay.
Yeah.
In the Philippines. Then I did the election book about the Florida recount. No, I'm going to take a break from reporting and focus on my CNN show. Although I'm really psyched that Sergeant Romache is going to be honored. And I talked to him yesterday. I mean, this is the thing about these guys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I feel like this whole interview, I'm like, this isn't funny. But
No. It's not funny.
But so I talked to Clint yesterday, Sergeant Romache, and he doesn't want this award. He doesn't want the Medal of Honor. He doesn't think he did anything. He wants, he starts talking about the eight guys that they lost, the eight guys who were killed. That's all he wants to talk about. And they start talking about other guys that were brave that day who survived, Brad Larson and Tom Rasmussen and others. And it's just that's who these guys are.
Yeah.
You know, I live in a town where people are not particularly like that.
No.
In an industry where people are not particularly like that.
Right.
But these guys are we're lucky that we have them.
Yeah. And the stories in this book are amazing, what they did for each other and what they tried to do for each other and what they tried to do really for the mission, you know. So it's a terrific tribute to them, the Outpost. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks,
Great talking to you. Good luck at CNN.
Thank you.
You're going to rip it up, I know. Jake Tapper.